Thank you for joining Marianne Gebauer podcast. And I am delighted to be joined by a Newfoundlander today. We met, Karen Hies and I had our first chat, and I was absolutely fascinated with some things that she shared with me. So I asked if we could have another chat and record it. So Karen Hies, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning.
My pleasure, Marianne.
So Karen, let's start just to give people an idea of where you are. You are in the Bonavista Peninsula in Trinity, Eastern Newfoundland, on the Bight, which is a term I've never heard of before. But just so people have an idea of where you are, tell us the story of how you ended up in Newfoundland, because you're originally from Ontario.
Yeah, I came on holiday in 2001, and I promptly packed my bags and took a 2-month leave of absence to come out and work in the tourism industry. And I took a 2-month leave from my job as a flight attendant, and the first month of my leave was 9/11. And I walked by the window of a local carpenter who decided the next day after the towers fell that if the world was coming to an end, he had as good a chance as any with the new missus in town. And the next day he came knocking. And here we are.
And here you are. And you've been there ever since. So you've been in Newfoundland for about 20 years. Tell me what happened with COVID in Newfoundland, because it seems as though the experience in Newfoundland is different, unique, as opposed to the rest of Canada.
Newfoundland, you know, seemed to be really captured by the COVID narrative. And for those of us who had questions or concerns, it was a very isolating experience. And it was really hard to find other people in the community who could even have a conversation about that. And as they ramped up, rather, the consequences of not following the narrative, then people became even more likely to succumb. They, you know, when people would say, oh, I'm not getting the shot. But then when it became mandated, people went and got the shot. If they had to choose between a paycheck and, you know, the freedom to say no thank you, they went and got the shot. And even people who weren't working, it just became so inconvenient to stand apart that they went and got the shot. And so even people who were reluctant at first or didn't feel it necessary clearly didn't understand what we believed, which was this was a life and death choice. And they didn't ever seem to see that element, except for the few of us who held out and gradually found each other.
So what do you think it is about Newfoundlanders that makes them more susceptible to the psyop?
It's all speculation for me. I don't know. I have some ideas that it probably has to do with the depressed economy here. It's a very limited economy here. You know, we've got a little bit of fishing left. We've got a tourism industry, but most of those industries are highly dependent on EI. We have a heritage carpentry industry maybe, but most of those are dependent on government subsidy on some level to get through the year. Because a lot of these are seasonal industries. So I suspect that there's a state dependence there. Mm-hmm. And historically, you know, I think to understand Newfoundlanders, you have to understand the merchant trade. I mean, when Newfoundland was first discovered and became, the basis of a seasonal cod fishery, the merchants from Europe came over. And they controlled the price of goods that Newfoundlanders needed to subsist here. They graded the fish that the Newfoundlanders fished, and they set the price of the fish. And so Newfoundlanders historically were very powerless in that relationship. And I think that leaves kind of an indelible mark. And these communities historically were very isolated, even up until recent generations. There was no highway like we know them now. They were only built in the 60s, I think, here, 50s. There was no hydro before the 1950s or 60s in some of these outports. So, you know, these communities were very self-sufficient. They had to rely on each other to get through the months of the year where no boats brought supplies. And so community was very important. And so, you know, you had to put everybody's interests with your own, I think, in order to survive collectively. And so that instinct to consider everyone else ahead of yourself, maybe, or, mm-hmm. you know, as equal to you was very ingrained here. And so I think when the COVID narrative became, you've got to do one to keep everybody else safe, I think that really hit them. And it was, you know, I'd rather be baking cookies with Nan, or, you know, we've got to protect Nan, you know, which is what they call grandma here. So there was this very much this mentality that you had to do it for the sake of everybody else. And so I think for those of us who had real concerns about safety, and really felt that it was way too dangerous to do that, you know, everybody else very much saw us as a threat that they needed to protect themselves from. And so there was, you know, there's no remorse about having sort of, you know, watched us be pushed out of society in general.
And you were pushed out. It sounded as though church attendance, you needed a vaccine passport. Share that experience.
So I was doing my yoga teacher training at that time. We had been gathering in person, except when, you know, the provincial, you know, health update said nobody could gather in person. We all gathered. But 10 months into a 12-month program, we were told if you didn't have a vax pass, you couldn't come to the studio anymore. We were told that we couldn't go to a gathering for Remembrance Day at the Community War Memorial because they were going to go into the church after that to have a little celebration of these plaques that they had just unveiled about all of the Newfoundlanders from this area who were killed during the wars. But if you didn't have a vax pass, you wouldn't be allowed in the church part. And we, you know, I always sang with the local choir. There's a small group of people who gather to do gospel, you know, sing-alongs or Christmas sing-alongs. And that year I didn't get an invitation. So I saw that the door of the church was open and I went in and I asked my neighbor, you know, is it the choir or the church that uninvited me this year? And he said, well, if you don't have a vax pass, you won't get in the door. So we couldn't attend Christmas Mass with our neighbors. And Eric's family's roots go back to the 1800s here. And Christmas always, you know, involved a church service. Hmm. So there, I couldn't take my son to the movie that the local historical society put on because you had to have a vax pass to get in the door of our town council office to go see a movie with your child. And we're talking about a community of a few hundred people, like an area, you know, that probably doesn't have 1,000 residents. And there's, in the old part of town here, there's only 40 odd of us in the wintertime. It's very much a seasonal sort of community here. So, you know, to be singled out in a community of a few dozen people is a pretty significant isolating experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's heartbreaking to hear that. Tell me now, once the vaccine was rolled out beginning in December 2020, what have you witnessed in terms of the health of your community?
Well, Newfoundland was always an aging population, but they generally lived good, long, healthy lives. But Newfoundlanders are also among, I think, the most obese population in, you know, by province in the country, depending where you check the statistics. So there's also declining health overall. But I mean, we're witnessing unprecedented numbers of deadly cardiac events, of strokes, of debilitating illnesses, of death. I went on the website of one of our local funeral homes here and added up the number of obituaries in the last year, just out of curiosity after our last conversation. And it was 95 people. And I added up the number of obituaries the previous year during the COVID vaccine rollout, and it was 75. And in the years prior to that, dating back to 2011, when the obituaries were listed, year over year, it averaged, you know, 55, 45, 49, 57.
Well, so this is almost a double. This is an 80% increase in deaths since December 2020, when the vaccine rolled out.
And I measured the dates from December 16th, when the first shot was administered in Newfoundland in 2020. And I measured from December 16th to December 16th. And we're not at December 16th of 2023 yet. We have a week to go. And weekly, there's, you know, a car accident, there's a death, there's a heart attack, there's a funeral, there's, you know, it feels certainly. And it's, you know, people are getting, you know, stage 4 cancer diagnoses and dying within weeks. I mean, we never saw that here. So it's not just the disability and the diminishing health. I mean, it's the sudden death. It's unprecedented.
That is extraordinary. And that's hard data from 2011. So you have 12 years of data. There's something extraordinary going on in your area. I mean, this is a funeral home. Vardy's funeral home is... represents what area?
Well, here there's a handful of funeral homes. And so if someone dies here, they're usually laid out in the church, but the services are provided from, you know, someone in a service center, you know, mm-hmm. either in Bonavista or Clarendonville or, mm-hmm. you know, a larger center somewhere else. But there's only a handful of companies that do that. So I checked the website for one of our local funeral homes. There would be others. But yeah, it seems that, you know, the ambulance is certainly steady going. You know, the fire departments are volunteer here, but they answer to all the first responder calls that come mm-hmm. in. Mm-hmm. And there certainly seems to be a lot more activity there.
Well, that is extraordinary data, and I'm going to try to have a look at that data. I think it should be out there published because it's very compelling. Mm-hmm. Since 2011, an 80% increase in deaths in your community.
Yeah, and COVID. You know, when it first started, it was, you know, the seniors who've been, you know, living in homes that, you know, haven't been well. But, you know, now it's recently retired folks who just suddenly drop dead, or a firefighter who has a heart attack at the scene of a, you know, an incident, or, you know, people who are otherwise quite healthy and not a candidate for stroke having a stroke, or dads who, you know, are volunteer firefighters who are having, you know, a sudden death, you know, and they've got young children. I mean, it's happening to people who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s,
which, yeah.
not not our typical population of, you know, the 80 somethings and the 90 somethings, we would lose a couple of each winter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What, when you speak to people in the community, what do, are they witnessing this? Are they aware of it? What are they saying?
There doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement of that in conversation, you know, and I find that's one of the things that really complicates my grief, because you can't talk about what you think is at play. Not that it changes the grief, but it compounds my grief when I believe that this was malfeasance, that I believe there's an agenda of depopulation, when I believe that we've been really intentionally harmed. And you can't talk about that because you don't want to isolate the people who are grieving, genuinely grieving, mm-hmm. and baffled, and, you know, have not had time to process, or to, you know, even say goodbye to their loved ones often. So it's almost like you have to closet a certain part of your grief, and just go out and be present with others, but you can't talk about that additional heartache that comes from believing that, you know, this was unavoidable and unnecessary.
Oh.
And, you know, we've even lost people to, you know, drug overdoses or, you know, suicide, because people are in despair.
Tell me a little bit about Dr. Stephen Bate, who was testifying at the National Citizens Inquiry. He is from Newfoundland. And tell me a little bit of what he presented. There was some very interesting data that he presented and some observations.
Yeah, so I listened to some of the testimony of the National Citizens Inquiry, and when I heard him talk, he exposed to me for the first time that the cycle threshold for the PCR test that they ran in Newfoundland was 45. And anything above 26 is useless. And I mean, it's an exponential function. So he talks about, you know, if you take a loony, how many trillions of dollars this exponential function ends up being, which helps to explain the fraud and how people were really misled, I think, by the information that was being put out by the government and the public health agencies. And I mean, here life is already very isolating because the population is aging and it's very rural and very spread out. So everybody was even that much more isolated and was listening to these daily, you know, broadcasts by the government to get their information. And they were being pumped full of, you know, incredible fear. And then the other thing Dr. Bate talked about was, you know, the statistics. The government was advertising that 100% of people over 70 have been fully vaxxed in the province. But he said in his testimony that he knew of 21 people in two communities within basically an hour's drive of one another that were unvaxxed in that population group. And so, you know, we were made to feel like everybody was doing it, and if the last few of you would just do it, we could get back to normal. And people were saying that, you know, they were saying, oh, well, when the last 10% of you holdouts stop, you know, holding out, we can get on with life. And they had never given us any guarantee that that was the case. And we genuinely believed that this was about something else and that our health was at risk. And so, but there was this incredible pressure because, you know, it was because we wouldn't conform that everybody couldn't get back to normal.
So in other words, Dr. Bate says that he knows 21 seniors over 70 who were not vaccinated, yet the government statistics say that in the whole country, there's 35 people over 70 who were not vaccinated. And he just happens to know 21 of them in two small communities.
What he was saying was that for 99.9% of the population or something to be vaccinated, like even just to take that 0.01% of the population, he said that would require only 31 people in the entire province. And he said he knew of 21 in two communities within an hour's drive that were not.
Which tells me the government is lying. The government data has been grossly embellished to give the unvaccinated the impression that they're alone.
Yeah, I think that would certainly
their numbers, they exaggerated, it sounds to me. This sounds very similar to what has come out of the New Zealand data that the whistleblower released. The fellow that ran the database for the whole country of New Zealand, for those who were vaccinators, they needed to be compensated. And he ran the database. He had all the data for all of New Zealand. And the data showed that only 2 million people were vaccinated. And yet the government of New Zealand data shows that 4 million people were vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his data over the government data. I think that that whistleblower revealed something quite interesting, that they doubled, essentially, the numbers to give the impression.
Well, it certainly seems to be coming out now that the data that the governments have published are being manipulated.
Yes.
You know, you can hear Dr. Bridle talk about how, you know, so many Canadians were resuscitated, apparently, because all of a sudden they just, all these dead people disappeared from the statistics. And you can listen to, you know, Rodney Palmer's testimony at the NCI, and he talks about how the CDC just lies. They lie. So I think for those of us who were willing to question, we were willing to question the numbers, and we were willing to question what we were being told. But when, you know, the CBC has, you know, been this sort of lifeline to the outside world, you know, the rest of Canada, and, you know, has been where you go to get the news your whole life. You know, it's hard to believe that they're lying to you. And it's one thing to see that they're trying to coerce people into doing things. It's another to believe that you've been outright deceived. It's harder to accept. And I know that when we drive around in the evening here, you can drive by pretty much every house in town, and you can see the light from the TV flickering off the walls and through the window. So I know that as people are isolated here, and, you know, everybody spends their night, you know, watching the TV instead of what they did a generation or two ago, which was went next door to the neighbors and had a conversation and a card game. Or, you know, that element of community has very much eroded in just a generation or two here. I mean, here there was no electricity, there was no TV, there, you know, and people gathered and they built community, and they, you know, they helped each other in their day-to-day work and taking up their gardens. And, you know, and it's easy to see how communities eroded here with TV, certainly.
Yeah, I think there is a correlation. You look at continent of Africa, where people generally are not big into TV. These are continents or countries where the people were not, did not believe the narrative. The community is strong. They're chatting with their neighbors. The family is intact and high functioning. It's harder to lie to a group of people when they are connected.
And I think one of the things that tipped me off, you know, I had a friend at the time who had her own shop, and she had a young child, and she said, you know, the world treats me like a pariah, basically, because I'm in contact with all these people. And I thought, you know, it's so hard to be a mom, a single mom of a young child, and not have support. I remember calling her during the pandemic and said, do you want to come over and bring your kid and maybe, you know, go out by yourself for an hour? She said, yes. And she came and she went for a run and she left her child with me. And, you know, and that's when my instinct started to say, there's something really wrong with this narrative that we want to isolate these people, but then make them go out and be available when we need groceries and, you know, necessities. And it was the inconsistencies in the message that I think really tipped me off.
You know, I want to jump back to Dr. Stephen Bate and allow people to find that interview. I think you mentioned it was day one of the National Citizens Inquiry that took place in Truro. And you mentioned that he spoke at the 5 hour, 20 minute mark, or 39 minute mark, 5 hour, 39 minutes. And he spoke for 20 minutes. So for people that want to see his testimony, the National Citizens Inquiry or the NCI website allows you to find all of these. So I think people, I'm going to go look for that conversation or that testimony, because I think it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, these details came out in the later part of his testimony. He talked a lot about the Pfizer documents and the government statistics that were coming out. Generally, but when he got into the specifics about Newfoundland at the end, I thought that was quite telling. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to put in the notes to this talk, I'm going to put a link to that interview. And I think I'll also put a link to the Vardy's funeral home. Now, I would imagine once the government gets wind that there's very clear data here, very compelling data, they'll probably pull the data or insist that, you know, Vardy's pulls their data. But I think I'll post it. I'll post the link just so people can go in and see for themselves. That's extraordinary data, raw data. Talk to me a little bit more about what it's like to be in Newfoundland with all of the woke agenda. What's going on in Newfoundland?
Well, we live in a very rural part, and I thought, you know, surely parts of this agenda won't make it here, you know, but our son was in school. They were doing a system-wide math test. The kids were told by the staff that they were weeks or months behind in the math lessons for that year, and the test was happening that week. And the kids were really stressed because they felt that they were unprepared because they knew that they were behind. And they pulled the kids out of school and sent them to a trans hate talk with a transgender person in the gym. And we went into the farmers market in St. John's recently. And there was no Santa. You couldn't get your picture taken with Santa, but you could get your picture taken with the snow drag queen. So there was a fellow there wearing a white dress with a white wig and a snowflake on a stick and a silver beard and mustache that looked fake, like it was pasted on. And you could get your picture taken with the snow drag queen at the farmer's market. And, you know, I had a conversation with an educator who doesn't work in our community, but is an educator, about, you know, the transgender agenda and why this is being pushed. And she said, well, you know, these transgender youth have an average lifespan of 26. They're suicidal. They, you know, they really struggle. And I started looking into this. And traditionally, transgender affected predominantly boys, a very small percentage of the population, and now 60% of the people transitioning are girls who are having double mastectomies right off the bat. But you couldn't have a conversation because this person was so determined that we had to save all of these transgender kids who are out there. And I said, how many kids are we messing with to save the ones who probably already, in my experience growing up, stick out from the crowd. It's not like you don't know who they are or you can't find them. So why are we preaching this agenda to everyone? And in my experience, kids are very, very self-conscious about their bodies as they're going through these teen years. I mean, most girls feel dreadful about their body, whether they're drop dead gorgeous or not. There's this discomfort that takes a long time to get over. In my experience, you know, women are, you know, I would say you spend your 20s getting over your teen years, you know. And so I wonder how many people are being captured by this narrative simply because they feel uncomfortable. Generally, you know, with the stage of life that they're at. So all of that is even creeping in here where, you know, in my experience, there aren't a whole lot of kids who are, you know, clearly struggling with these issues. So it's very much a global agenda, it seems. And, you know, even our town plan recently is up for a redo. And, you know, there was language in that town plan around rising sea levels, and people wouldn't be allowed to build a slipway or a, you know, a stage on the water if they were below the estimated storm surge levels in the year 2100. I said, we're talking about a potentiality that's 85 years in the future. That's a long lifetime. And we're talking about an exceptional weather event, a storm surge level, not a average sea level, that's going to devastate property values and what people can do to access the water in historically fishing communities. And so they had a look at this and they decided that they weren't going to enforce this, but the town plan now has to go to the province. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the province puts in. But, you know, the whole climate change agenda, the whole transgender agenda, the whole, it's all here. It's all here.
Two things that strike me when you talk about this, I think of Newfoundlanders as being quite traditional. I would not think that they would be very swayable in all of this woke transgender narrative. Is there not pushback from the traditional Newfoundlander?
I think what's happening, I've had some interesting conversations, one with one of our local paramedics who said, you know, I'm the most reviled thing on earth. I'm a middle-aged white guy, you know. And we talked about the J.K. Rowling witch trials and this whole TERF, you know, trans exclusionary radical feminist and this whole trans agenda and the whole, you know, and that was all news to me. I went and watched it subsequently out of respect for him and our conversation. But the thing about it is every time you speak out, you're the one who's called a hater. You're the one who's called intolerant. And part of me said, am I going to go to this school and am I going to tackle them on this issue of, you know, this transgender hate thing? Am I really going to do that? Because every time you speak out, every time I feel like I speak out, I feel like I'm the only one who's speaking out because I'm the only one who sees that this is part and parcel of a bigger agenda. And I'm already isolated on the vaccine issue. I'm already isolated on, you know, the COVID issue. I'm already outed, you know, with the local politics around the climate change agenda, you know, and it becomes easier and easier for them to say, oh, she's that whack job for their, like, you know, and so they stop listening because you represent everything that they can't see. And so you choose your battles. And one of the ones for me that I'm dealing with at the school level is the tech in the classroom. They said, I know you said no thanks to the Chromebook for your kid, but he really needs a Chromebook available in order to be able to contribute in class. I said, I don't want Google and Microsoft to be surveilling our kids and their activities in school. I would really rather he wasn't doing that on a computer. And, you know, we spent generations learning with a pencil and paper. So I find, first of all, most people here are retired. They're older. They don't have kids in the system. They might have grandkids in the system. So you end up having some really interesting conversations with the grandparents. But a lot of the, I mean, my son was the only child born here in a 10-year period. There are only four kids who get on the bus, and we have a K to 12 school that has 100 students in it total. And so I think people are afraid to speak out because they're the ones who will be called a hater. It always gets turned, you're intolerant. And so, you know, we don't need to listen to you because, you know, what's your issue with transgender people? I don't have an issue with people and their choices. I have an issue with being expected to fly everyone else's flag, because I think the more we talk about our differences, the more divided we become. And what I realize is that the agenda is to divide and conquer. And the more they can create division, and by calling everybody a hater who doesn't support an issue or celebrating a difference or a diversity, mm-hmm. is a way of, it fuels the division, and it reduces the connection in the community and the collective good, in a sense, because it's all about, we got to celebrate everything that makes us different instead of coming together. And I say to people, if I just accept the people around me and the choices that they make and let them live their lives, then there need not be any division. So it's hard to combat the agenda and what you see as induced divisiveness that's being sort of pushed on all of us. And it's hard to figure out how to build community when the community's really let you down and really hurt you and isolated and excluded you. But when you see that the only way forward is love and rebuilding, you know, our collective humanity. So it's hard.
Is there any issue that you think the Newfoundlanders may, like there's a crack, you know, in some communities it's with farmers, that they begin to see, wait a minute, we're being controlled and manipulated here. What might be the issue in Newfoundland that allows people to see there's something not right here?
Well, I, you know, it's interesting because I come back to, you know, we live in a very tiny community that really can't afford a water and sewer system, for instance, and the quality of the water is not what people want or need. Newfoundland historically was a fishing community. It's what built Newfoundland was the salt cod fish. And, you know, Newfoundlanders have to participate in a summer fishery. And in July and August, you're allowed to go out on a Saturday, Sunday, or a Monday. You can collect 5 fish per person to a maximum of 15 per boat. So you have to go out every day and get 5 fish until you have enough for the winter. You can't go out when the fishing is good and the weather is good and get your season's worth of fish. And I don't think they do this to any of the other Atlantic provinces. And Newfoundlanders rage against it. They rant and they roar, as the song says, like true Newfoundlanders, but they comply and they comply and they comply and they follow the rules. And as silly as the rules get, they continue to follow the rules. And part of me says, maybe there's space to say, hey, how about we all get in our boats? How about we all go out one day? How about we all, but yeah. Rallying people to a cause seems to be difficult. And it seems to be difficult in Canada in general. I mean, you look at basic things like the cost of cell phones or, you know, so I don't know. I think people are are going to reach a breaking point, because with the economy as limited as it is here in some ways, people are going to be hard pressed to be able to put gas in their car to get to work, to keep a roof over the head and food on the table, because the cost of things here is significant relative to what people are earning. And I think the day is going to come when people aren't going to be able to afford those three basic things. And, you know, demand for things like food banks are already, you know, markedly on the rise. So I don't know. I don't know if there's a way to gather community around, you know, people's shrinking ability to provide the basics for themselves and their family and their loved ones, and build something from that. Our farmers are getting pushed out of farming. I mean, a number of the farmers that I know have gotten out of raising fowl. The bird flu went through here this summer, and seabirds were washing up in the hundreds on the shores of Newfoundland, and they culled all of the birds at all of the farms everywhere, including the peacocks at Lester's Farm Market in St. John's, for goodness sake. So there's, you can see the pushing out of farmers, but farmers are being pushed out. The farm I bought beef from last year got rid of his beef cattle. You know, the farmer I buy my Christmas and Thanksgiving turkeys from got out of doing fowl at all. So it's getting harder and harder to source local meat, for one. So I don't know. I don't know where there's room to grow. And that's what I struggle with. How do you build back community and build resilience into your community?
Mm-hmm.
And bring people together to stand.
Well, it sounds like Newfoundlanders are perfect candidates for the universal basic income, which has already passed the second reading in the Senate. They are already rather dependent and so compliant. So when that rolls out, and if it's coordinated with the central bank digital currency, seems to me that Newfoundlanders are perfectly poised to adopt.
When COVID hit and they offered the $500, it was more than most people here were making on their EI or on welfare. So the COVID money has actually resulted in a very limited pool of employees here, because most people don't want to go to work. And that's part of that whole state dependence. You know, most of the industries here are seasonal. They're on EI. So now they only want to work 14 weeks to qualify for EI. They don't want to work any longer than that. They don't want to go to work if you can't guarantee them 14 weeks, because they can't survive without that EI in the winter. And the COVID money took the employees out of the small business. And I think that was a very intentional mode of destroying small business here. Because there are restaurants that never reopened. There are businesses that never reopened after COVID, and everyone is advertising for staff and can't get it. And these are businesses that never advertised for staff. They were never hurting for people to go to work. They were, you know, enviable places to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And now everyone is short-staffed. Businesses are closed for certain hours of the day or certain days of the week because they haven't got staff.
What do the locals say about this then? They must notice this. Their favorite restaurants or pubs are closing, their favorite small businesses.
Yeah, I don't know that they've put it together. I don't know that they've put it together. But I think, you know, people do recognize on some level that that free money, and there's a, you know, they think this money is free. And it's really interesting. I'm just reading Ayn Rand's book, The Fountainhead, and he talks about how, you know, the people who are, you know, who need an apartment at $15 a week are basically bankrupting the ones who are, you know, making $40 a week, because their tax money has to pay to compensate for all of the government spending to carry the ones who aren't earning enough or can't earn enough. Or so it's interesting. I think people see that the COVID money and EI have created this erosion of a working class base, you know, but I'm not sure they've pieced together that there's an agenda there. And I don't think they've pieced together that the universal basic income is a gateway into the slavery that is the CBDC.
Is there any discussion of 15-minute cities in Newfoundland?
So it's interesting because I am tied into an organization and people on the mainland were talking about that. I said, I don't even know what that is. But when I saw the town plan, I saw that the 15-minute city agenda shows up here a little bit differently in terms of what we were talking about with rising sea levels. And, you know, but the town plan now has all this language around bike lanes. I mean, if Newfoundland has to subsist on bike lanes, our nearest grocery store is a 15-minute car ride. And it's a very limited, it's the sort of the equivalent of shopping at your corner store on the mainland. You can't get a huge variety of things, much less good quality or high end or single ingredient. You know, it's a lot of processed stuff. If you want to get an organic rice or a, you know, good luck. And so, you know, there's all this language in town plans around mining. There's all this language in town plans about we're not going to make restrictions on the companies that are going to come in and provide cell service or so the monitoring systems, you're seeing all of that language come in here. 5G, you're seeing all of this creeping in, but people aren't aware that there's an agenda there. Everybody's crying here that the cell phone service is horrendous and we've got to improve the cell phone service. And I'm like, they're going to put towers on every light pole in town that are going to exponentially increase our 5G exposure or exposure to EMF, which is a real risk to our health. But they, you know, it's like Catherine Austin Fitt says, stop building the prison. People can't wait to build the prison here. They can't wait because they want better cell phone service and they want, you know, and they don't see that those things are contrary to our freedom and contrary to our health. And so I tried to deal with some of those things with the town plan and the town council, but they, you know, read my paper and then said, okay, so we're either going to have to improve the cell phone tower, you know, in Loxton here, or they're going to have to come and put little mini stations on all the hydro poles. And we live in a heritage community that's all wooden construct, basically. The town plan, you know, you have to use wooden clapboard. You have to, because they've maintained the beautiful historic architecture of Trinity. But I don't think you want to have these things on every light pole when there's a risk.
As well, is there an attempt to get people off the land and into the city? Because the whole concept of the 15-minute city is to cluster people together and to control them.
Well,
so do you see that trend in Newfoundland where people are leaving the land and congregating?
Well, you see the urbanization, right? But here that means people go to St. John's or they go to the mainland, and they always have. People have always worked either, you know, they work on the offshore supply boats here, or they work on the Great Lakes boats and they're gone for months of the year. Or they work on the ferry boat and they go a month on and a month home. A lot of people do fly-in work. So they work on the mainland somewhere and then they come home for a couple of weeks and then they go back up to Alberta or to, you know, Northern Ontario, or they work on a ship. That's always historically been part of Newfoundland outport life. And what's interesting, when we had conversations recently, you know, at funerals, we talked about how in my husband's parents' generation, people lived and worked and raised their families in these communities. And they would have a family of five kids and live in a two-bedroom house and have their father-in-law living with them. And now most people are driving an hour to work in a hospital or a supply center up there, they're not living and working and earning a living in the community. There's a handful of jobs in, you know, the heritage carpenter trades. But they're working for people who have a second and a third home here. They don't live here. It's becoming what we call a millionaire's playground. And we joked during COVID, we always knew it would become a gated community. We're just on the wrong side of the gate. We're still here and they can't come. But it's changing. People from all over the world are buying property here. And the locals now can't really afford to live here because they're going to be working in a tourism industry job for $15 an hour for 4 to 6 months of the year and living on EI, and they can't afford a $500,000 mortgage or a $250,000 house that then needs a total retrofit. So nobody local is buying property and living here. And so you see people are leaving to go to the mainland or go to St. John's, you know, to survive. But those that are still here are going to struggle ever harder to hold on to what they've got. Mm-hmm. Because costs are rising, you know, exponentially. You know, the cost of chain oil for a chainsaw here. And I mean, a lot of people cut their own wood. The cost of chain oil went up 50%, bam, 1 year from one winter to the next. So the cost of living here is becoming difficult to maintain.
Fascinating. Well, you know, I always think of Newfoundland and I think back to the musical Come From Away that featured all the plains that descended upon Gander, was it?
Yep.
And St. John's during the 9/11 crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think the beautiful warmth and hospitality and authenticity of the Newfoundland people. And unfortunately, my impression is that they have been completely bamboozled by all of this. And it's heartbreaking because they're mm-hmm. so trusting. They're beautiful people. But they've become very dependent on the government, as you describe. And they're very susceptible to these, these manipulations in the media by the government. So my hope is that somehow a group gets established in Newfoundland where, you know, you can speak the same language and somehow wake up your friends, your neighbors, family, because it's heartbreaking to hear this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Really heartbreaking. How can people contact you, or is there a group in Newfoundland that of aware people that, you know, get together on Zoom calls, or what is your community in Newfoundland?
So I'm a chapter leader for Vaccine Choice Canada, so people can find me that way. And there's another chapter in Western Newfoundland, in Springdale. There's a group in St. John's. Dana is largely behind that, and it's you can find the Raven there. I met a woman in the supermarket who saw my T-shirt that said it was from Tom McDonald, and it said, "Freedom, family, faith, firearms, fuck you, hangover gang." She came running after me in the supermarket. So they have an organization called Boots on the Ground. Mm-hmm. So there are a handful of communities, if you can tap into one of them. A lot of them are in the St. John's area. But yeah, you know, you have to, in my experience, be willing to speak the truth and find them, which means you're going to talk to a lot of people who don't see thinks the same way as you.
One thing that I have found effective, and I wonder if it's a strategy that might be effective in Newfoundland, is I say to people, oh, have you looked up your batch? Well, of course, people say, excuse me, what do you mean? I say, have you looked up your batch to see what the injuries are or the deaths associated with your vaccine batch? Well, people always find that, you know, they're intrigued, they're curious. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. howbad.org, I think it is. So I give them that website. And then I say, also, you know, if you are injured, there's the Vaccine Injury Support Program out of Ottawa that will compensate you for your injuries. And again, people, that fear of missing out, it's like, well, wait a minute, I better look into that. Maybe I do have an injury. So I find that those two bits of information are very effective. When you're talking with someone who is not aware, I just throw that out. If I'm talking to a teller, if you know, just when I'm out and about, I throw that out there. And yeah. I find that 9 times out of 10, people are jotting down the name of howbad.org. They want to look up their batch, and they also are thrilled to think that they can get compensated. Who doesn't want free money, especially in Canada? So that would be something I'd recommend. It's quite effective in BC, yeah. But I would imagine it would be even more effective in Newfoundland.
Yeah. We, mm-hmm. I mean, we do gather when there's a worldwide rally, people will come from quite a ways away. And so, you know, you do meet a few people there, and then you can follow, you know, along. We did go to see James Top. And so people would, mm-hmm. you know, people will gather around those kinds of events. And then, you know, you can mix and mingle and meet a few people and swap numbers and things. Mm-hmm. So if you can get a finger on the pulse through any one of the organizations that's here, then, you know, when there's an event to gather around, you'll find like-minded yeah. people.
What I can do is put those links as well into the notes so that people have ready access, because I think yeah. that's the most important aspect of it all right now, is building a community, having a network.
Yeah. And in Canada, there's an organization called Freedom Rising, and they have a website, and all of the organizations that are on the forefront of the freedom movement, and they all have a different passion. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all there and they're listed, and you can get in touch with one. And, you know, when you get in touch with one, you'll know what the others are doing. And they have a Friday afternoon freedom call that anybody can get in on. So if people are interested, you know, they can certainly reach out to Vaccine Choice Canada or to any of the chapters in their area. And then they can check out Freedom Rising. I think it's freedomrising.org. But anyway, there's lots of organizations, and, you know, they tend to sort of keep their finger on the pulse of what's happening collectively. Mm-hmm.
One last question I have. Have you talked to Newfoundlanders who do not live in Newfoundland anymore? And what is their view of what's going on in Newfoundland? Are Newfoundlanders unique in being susceptible to this PSYOP no matter where they live across the country? Or are the Newfoundlanders that left more apt to see what really is going on?
So the Newfoundlanders that I have met, you know, I met one couple at a freedom rally, a worldwide freedom rally, and they spent a number of years away, and they said, this is not the Newfoundland we left. And, you know, it's interesting because so many Newfoundlanders work away and have spent decades working away. But that doesn't necessarily, you know, there's no rhyme nor reason to it in that regard. There are Newfoundlanders who spent decades working away or continue to work away who, you know, can't see what's happening, or went and got the jab anyway because they needed to or they couldn't go to work. And, you know, the other thing I've, you know, been thinking about what's happened in Newfoundland historically, and when, you know, this very proud, very resilient, very self-sufficient population, you know, became so susceptible to this. And, you know, one of the interesting things, the theater here does a brilliant show called No Man's Land that's based on a book by Kevin Major. And the First World War, the Newfoundland Regiment, because Newfoundland was not yet part of Canada then, went off to fight in the First World War. And an entire generation of Newfoundlanders, basically, of their best and most able-bodied, went off to war and were killed in a single battle, in the Battle of the Somme. And, you know, you think about the effect that that had on this place, you know, when all of its sons went off to die. And I mean, there's been incredible tragedies, you know, even in the sealing industry during that same period of time. There were two boats that went missing. So, you know, Newfoundlanders have known tragedy, and there's been a lot of loss. And I sometimes wonder how, you know, that's affected the psyche here too, because people must know how hard they had to struggle to get by before they had an EI check or Confederation or Canada to lean on. And so, yeah, it's interesting. So, but it there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to, you know, why some are captured and others are not necessarily.
Well, Karen, this has been fascinating chatting with you. I feel you definitely have your finger on the pulse in the Newfoundland experience. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share with me, because it's unique. I mean, when I ran into a gal from St. John's last year in Costa Rica, and we were the first people she'd ever met that were not vaccinated, I almost fell over. That, where are you from again? You know, but this is Newfoundland. So I think it's extraordinary. It's an extreme situation.
Yeah, that's going on. Mm-hmm. There's an incredible level of trauma. And those of us who, you know, have stood, you know, we say, well, we chose life, lucky us. But the trauma of having been so isolated, and that people felt that you were a threat that made you disposable to the collective society was really painful. And I listened to Meredith Miller. She did a talk with Vaccine Choice Canada, and she talked about trauma. And she said, it doesn't end when the perpetrators are brought to justice. It doesn't end when people come around to seeing the agenda. It ends when you reclaim your power of choice. And so our goal is to get back to living joyfully and to reclaiming our power of choice. And yeah, Meredith's presentation is really good. But I think we're beginning to realize just how deep the trauma goes, because now the invitations are coming to be part of, you know, what you were left out of, you know, 2-3 years ago. But there's no apology, there's no remorse, there's no acknowledgement even. People just want to pick up where we left off. And for those of us who were left out for so long, it's very, very painful, because we've been so secluded in our experience. And it's kind of scary to want to re-engage with people who basically disposed of you once. But you kind of pine for that belonging and community. And so the more of us we can gather, you know, and share and heal and move forward, the better.
And I think if we are engaging with these people who have treated us rather poorly, it's important to be engaging with them, because in coming days, they're going to need our help, whether it's through illness, whether it's through navigating what's coming down the pipe, because this is not the end. It's only just begun, and they need us in their lives. because we're entering the, and we need each other. And somehow we have to pivot and get them to realize that we're not the enemy and they're not the enemy. The enemy is these globalists who are imposing their draconian ideologies and their fanaticism. Yeah. So that shift has to happen. And I feel somehow we do need to unite and get the focus on the perpetrators of this crime. Because ultimately, we're the victims.
Yeah, I listened to your interview with Fergus, and you know, he talks about that, the, you know, the different types of people and what motivates them and how to talk to them. And I think that's the thing, you know, like I, all through this, I hoped that if I planted seeds, that they would germinate and they would grow. And they haven't necessarily. But it almost feels now like you want to go out and you want to continue to try to get people to see, but without alienating yourself from them and them from you all the more. And maybe without carrying all of this hurt. And so I think that's why, you know, I'm reluctant to go out yet too much into the community, because I feel like there's more healing that needs to happen for all of us before I, and then I need to choose how I'm going to re-engage or how I'm going to engage or how I'm going to build some resilience into my surroundings for what's coming. Because we all need protected from what's coming, whether they can see it or not. They also need to be protected from this. Humanity needs to be preserved. So it's hard. It's so I think we have to get back in tune with our creative selves and really visualize the kind of world we want to live in and set about creating that somehow. Find your creative little niche for, you know, maybe you start up a food cooperative, or maybe, you know, you expand your capacity to farm so that you can afford to share with others. Maybe, you know, whatever it is, you know, you, but, you know, here we're certainly witnessing the debilitating effects of these shots on people's health, the diminishing of the population. So getting people who can help you to provide for what you need collectively as a community is going to be a real challenge. You know, finding somebody who can shovel your driveway when you can't do it anymore, finding someone who can cut your grass, you know, those are going to be the challenges going forward. You know, it's finding able-bodied people who can provide for the collective needs of the society. And, you know, we're certainly going to see that here.
Well, when you mentioned that you've had 18 funerals in your small community this last, now, I don't know what the time frame was,
about last year.
That's extraordinary in a small community like that, where you'd said there's normally one, maybe two. Now there's 18. So at some point, I think people, at what point will they wake up? But I'm glad you pointed out Fergus, because Fergus Greenwood has some wonderful techniques in how to navigate. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate his suggestions in terms of profiling who's who and figuring out how do you navigate with them.
And, you know, if nothing else, what he says is be kind and be right later. You know, we don't want to be right. He said, there's no joy on the front end of this or the back end of this. We don't want to be able to say, I told you so. That's not what it's about. It's, you know, it's all the layers of grief. I couldn't save them. I have to reconcile them to their own journeys. I'm going to have to be here to help them pick up the pieces when they do begin to see. They need a safe place to go when they start to piece it together. Let that be me. Let that, you know, be the organizations, you know, but until we can get to love mm-hmm. and get out of this hurt and this pain and this anger and this, you know, it's all about getting back to love, because, you know, it's what's going to sustain us all in the end. And so there's a lot of healing and a lot of grieving, I find, that needs to happen. And it seems to never end, but, you know, it's a spectrum and you make your way. So yeah, it's all about healing and getting to love, and then concentrating on how we're going to build resiliency into, you know, what's coming.
Well, Karen, I think that's a perfect place for us to end on a note of optimism. And I agree with you. I absolutely agree. So, Karen Heise, thank you so much for your time. It has been a delight to chat with you. And I haven't heard too many voices out of Newfoundland, so it's refreshing to hear yet another perspective.
Thank you. It's been a joy.